Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
It is the final episode of October here on Legal Face Off. WGN, WGNRadio.com. Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich and Ben Anderson always across the glass. Are you guys ready for Halloween? Do we have our costumes yet?
We are ready. This is our traditional Halloween episode. We'll be covering some Halloween stories at the end of our show. Tina, do you have your costume all set?
I'm wearing my fine orange plaid.
That's right.
To commemorate Halloween. So,
Sam, what are you going as this year?
The Legal Eagles. I might go as Rich Linkoff. I might bick the head. Yeah, I might shave the head
this year.
Yeah, so we got a lot to get to per usual. Police reform. We'll talk about the Illinois Attorney General race. Some lawsuits with the lottery, as that lottery might be over $1 billion. There could be some lawsuits after that. And, of course, at the end of the show, the legal grab bag. But we start with Erica Harold. Welcome back to the show. In studio this time, Republican candidate for Attorney General here in Illinois, getting ready for Election Day on November 6th. And she's an attorney with Meyer Capel in Champaign County. Welcome in, Erica.
Thanks for having me.
Very excited to have you in studio. This is great. You were on earlier on our show when you were in the primary. Now you're back in studio. We really appreciate you being in studio. We should note that this was intended to be a debate for the Attorney General spot, but we could not get Mr. Raul, your opponent, to commit to today. So it's going to be a one-person forum today. We really appreciate it. First question is, in Chicago, we're coming off, obviously, a very important decision in the Van Dyke trial. Jason Van Dyke, for those of you listening, of course, know that he was convicted of second-degree murder, very prominent shooting that was captured on video. This is about 3 weeks ago. We've got the Justice Department consent decree coming up. How does all that fit into your plans as Attorney General for law enforcement?
One of the most important tasks for the next Attorney General is to pursue very vigorous compliance with the consent decree, because this is a transformative moment for the city of Chicago and really for the nation, because a lot of people are paying attention to this. And there are a lot of great opportunities within enforcement of the consent decree to address issues like community policing, which helps to reduce violence and crime, to start to restore some of the trust between law enforcement and communities, and also to highlight issues such as trauma-informed care and making sure that law enforcement is able to better serve marginalized communities. It's also really important to make sure that the community stays involved, because one of the things that I will credit current Attorney General Lisa Madigan with doing is really giving the community as stakeholders the ability to articulate their concerns and to make sure that those concerns are effectuated in the consent decree itself.
So just pick up on one point before we go on. So Jeff Sessions, who is the Attorney General of the United States, has been very vocal in his opposition to the consent decree. You know, as Attorney General, as the top legal enforcement officer in our state, you'd face that dilemma, I imagine, of the Attorney General of the country being, you know, fighting what you're trying to enforce here in Illinois. How would you deal with that dichotomy?
It wouldn't be a dilemma at all, because I very strongly believe in this consent decree and the right of Illinois to be able to have this. It went through the proper legal procedures, and it was a process by which people had the ability to participate, and it will be a federal judge that actually puts it and issues it into law. And then the judge will appoint a independent monitor to actually start to make sure that the appropriate benchmarks are being met. And so I will consider it to be an honor to be able to be the person to enforce that consent decree and to make sure that the issues of justice that need to be addressed are fully addressed.
So switching gears a little bit to the governor's race, we have J.B. Pritzker and Bruce Rauner. Pritzker is enjoying a pretty considerable lead right now and is obviously a Democrat. So how would you work with him on the issues that are facing our state?
The role of the Attorney General is to be an independent constitutional officer and to operate your office without respect to the political affiliation of any other government official. And one of the reasons why I decided to seek this office is to try to take the politics out of the Attorney General's office. And so whoever is sitting in the governor's mansion, I will focus on my role to be able to hold both parties accountable and to really be an independent voice who is fighting for the people's interests, not political interests.
Any predictions on that you want to give us at this point?
I'm not in the job of political predictions at this point. Obviously, I'd like to see Governor Rauner reelected because I think that many of his policies, including stopping the progressive income tax, I think those are better for Illinois. But regardless of who's elected, I will do my job to be an independent voice and to take the politics out of the office. And I will not hesitate, though, to work with people on both sides of the aisle on issues such as criminal justice reform, addressing the opioid epidemic. Really, we have so many challenges in the state of Illinois, and we cannot continue to let petty partisan politics be a barrier for us working together on the things where we have common interests.
Talk to us about public corruption, because obviously, you know, that's been a big problem in our state. And also perception-wise, when you go out and talk to people in other states, I just came back from seeing some clients in Minnesota, and unfortunately the perception is when you say Chicago, a lot of times you hear about crime and murder, and you hear about corruption. You know, you don't hear about all the other great things that are happening in our state and our city. What would you do as Attorney General to fight corruption, and what are your thoughts on what's been done over the last several years by Lisa Madigan?
I've identified fighting public corruption as a top priority because, unfortunately, in the state of Illinois, public corruption has been a bipartisan problem. I was in a gift shop fairly recently where they had a T-shirt, and it had the mugshot of former Governor Blagojevich and a mugshot of former Governor Ryan, and it said, Illinois, where our governors make our license plates. Hmm. And there's this perception that Illinois has a high level of public corruption, and it certainly creates a disincentive for people to want to invest in our state, expand businesses. So there are a couple of things that the Attorney General can do. Right now, the Attorney General has statutory authority under the State Ethics Act if they have an Inspector General report that shows evidence of systemic misconduct to conduct investigations. And I believe I would be more vigorous and proactive in using that authority than Lisa Madigan has been. I also would call upon the General Assembly to further empower the Attorney General's office with additional investigative tools, such as additional subpoena power and the ability to convene statewide grand juries. The Attorney General is also in charge of the Public Access Counselor, which is charged with enforcing compliance with the Freedom of Information Act and the Open Meetings Act. And those sunshine laws are so important because they require public bodies to operate in an open and transparent way and to disclose information to the public and members of the media. And making sure that that public access counselor role is really fully effectuated is important because that's a way of preventing public corruption from occurring in the first place and really involving the community in being watchdogs as well.
So why don't we switch gears and talk a little bit about legalizing marijuana? Obviously, on a federal level, it's still considered a controlled substance. Where do you stand on the issue of legalizing marijuana?
I think that the federal government should allow states to make their own decision, and I think that Illinois should legalize marijuana for adult recreational use. Obviously, it requires setting forth proper regulations so that you're protecting young people, that you're protecting public safety, but there are many reasons why I think Illinois should pursue legalization. First of all, we have a mass incarceration problem where you have many people incarcerated for nonviolent marijuana-related offenses that I don't believe that's the proper use of our law enforcement resources. We also have an issue that I think is a much greater public health issue of the opioid epidemic. In 2016 alone, nearly 2,000 Illinoisans died of opioid-related overdoses, and we don't have enough resources right now to address that. I think that our law enforcement resources would better be directed towards that. And then there's an economic opportunity for marijuana-related businesses, and I think a state like Illinois that faces as many fiscal challenges as we do needs to be open to exploring different ways of having economic development.
Yeah, I think one study put it as almost $700 million in potential income from legal marijuana. We'll be covering later in our show the legalization in Canada. They're already out of cannabis, so I think that is the trend.
It's been a run on pot in Canada.
Canada is out of weed. Big news story.
I've never heard it put that way.
Rich, are you going to move back to Canada?
Yeah, I'm from Canada originally, as you can see from my lining.
Very nice.
Maybe there's a reason to move back now.
I'm sure listeners are wondering what we're doing here when you say my lining.
Yes, my suit lining. Sam, take it away, my
friend. So, Erica, yeah, Erica, I did.
It's a great
I did two hard. I did 2 hard years at the University of Illinois, so I know that area really well. 2 questions. Number one, where's the best place to get a slice? And number two, is there anything better than when Illinois is good in basketball?
I love
Who
Illinois
remembers
sports.
The answer to that question, by the way? It's been so long.
I have to say, I'm a big Fighting Illini sports fan, and I have a brother-in-law who played on the 2004-2005 Fighting Illini team.
Oh, wow.
And so that team obviously brought great memories to all of us, and there's nothing better than Champaign-Urbana when the sports teams are experiencing glory, because people are excited, the college students are excited, and it's great economic opportunities for our entire community. And I can't really pick just one place to get a slice because I'll alienate all sorts of friends.
Sam,
so
what's
I'm
the answer
plead
to that?
The fifth.
To me, it was Papa Dell's, but I think didn't Papa Dell's close down recently or it moved? So I was crushed when I heard that.
Papa Dell's is great. Garcia's was a local place that people went. I won't pick just one though because I've got friends in the industry.
You heard it here first.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Lots of friends. That's Erica Herold running for Attorney General as a Republican. The website, ericaherold.com, ericaherold.com. Thank you, Erica, so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Erica, when you become Attorney General, you promise to come back on Legal Face Off.
Absolutely.
Talk to us more about your plans.
Absolutely. Be happy to do that.
All right. You heard it here first. Thank you.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off on WGN Radio here in Chicago. Rich and Tina are here. Let's go to the phones. Karen Sheely is the Director of Police Practices Project at ACLU Illinois, ACLU-IL.org. Karen, welcome to Legal Face Off.
Thank you for having me.
So, Karen, there were 2 public hearings this week regarding the Chicago Police Reform Plan. Can you fill us in on what happened at the hearings this week?
Sure. The public hearings were hosted by Judge Dow, who is going to be making the decision about whether or not to enter the consent decree that's been proposed by the city and the Illinois Attorney General. That decree is a settlement agreement that has a number of proposals for reform of the department. And the public was allowed to come and tell Judge Dow about their experiences with the police and why reform was important to them. Some of our clients testified explaining their past experiences with the police. One mother talked about her fear of her son being exposed to use of force by law enforcement because he has a disability and may not follow instructions if he encounters a police officer. We also heard from the FOP and other police unions who are mostly opposed to the decree. But overall, it was a referendum on policing in Chicago, and the vast majority of people who attended supported the entry of the decree.
So, Karen, your organization, the ACLU, is in favor of the consent decree. You've said that it will bring more accountability and transparency to the police department. You mentioned that the FOP is against it. Jeff Sessions, who's the U.S. Attorney General, has also been very vocal lately in coming out against it for a number of reasons. What do you say to the critics of this consent decree? Among the criticisms being that it will effectively make police make their jobs impossible by adding all of these steps to an already very dangerous job.
Well, I would encourage people to I listened to the voices that spoke yesterday about the pain that people have suffered at the hands of the police department. There were ministers who talked about the experiences of people who were in their congregations. One woman spoke about how one of her congregants couldn't make it to a Northside church service without being stopped several times. Other people talked about the humiliation that they experienced at the hands of the police after being shot and crime situations. So it's definitely something that's deeply needed. In terms of restraints on the officers, one thing that became apparent during even the FOP testimony is that they want more training. There are pieces of this decree that are really necessary, and everyone agrees are necessary for reform. As to the remainder, other cities have gone through this process and come out the other side with better departments, improved public safety, and that can happen here in Chicago, too.
So, Karen, can you walk us through some of the different facets of the consent decree and also talk a little bit about some of those other cities that have implemented consent decrees before?
Sure. So this consent decree is aimed at trying to address a pattern and practice that the department has of using excessive force, in particular against Black and Latino Chicagoans. And the decree addresses this in a few ways, by encouraging and creating new community policing programs, having restraints on officers and checks on the department in terms of bias, improving the crisis intervention program when officers are interacting with people who are having a mental health crisis, reforming the use of force policies, and then kind of taking a look at the department's training, hiring, supervision, and accountability and transparency functions. All of these things are good best practices, things that many of which the department has promised to do in the past but hasn't come through on, and they're critical pieces of reform. But they're also very similar to the types of reforms that have been adopted by other cities. Baltimore, Seattle, New Orleans, Ferguson, Missouri, Los Angeles, Cincinnati, Cleveland, are all cities that have gone through this process of having a federal monitor and a federal court oversee the process of reform. And it's clearly needed here in Chicago because the department has tried to engage in self-reform over and over again, really over generations, and hasn't been able to make it stick.
Karen, a lot of the reforms in the consent decree date back to what happened in the wake of the 2015 release of the Laquan McDonald police shooting video. We're now about 3 weeks from the conviction by a Chicago jury of the officer, Jason Van Dyke, involved in that shooting, convicted of second-degree murder. How do you think that conviction will play a part in how this consent decree is rolled out, if any?
Well, I think that the conviction really, validated the experiences and the activism that's been going on in the city since the video was released. But it wasn't just a problem with one police officer that brought us here. It's a system and an approach to policing that Chicago has had for too long, and a failure on the part of the city to ensure that officers, that the small percentage of officers who do violate people's rights are overseen, disciplined, and fired when necessary. It's part of the backdrop. It instigated this process, but these problems were here all along.
That's Karen Shealy, the Director of Police Practices Project at ACLU Illinois, aclu-il.org. Karen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Let's go back to the phones one more time on Legal Face-Off. You can always follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and check us out. We're on iTunes. You can rate, review, and share with a friend. Rich and Tina, Sam and Ben joining us on the phones. Rob Wood, a managing partner at Wood LLP, also a contributor to Forbes, because we have a winner in the huge lottery here, the winner from South Carolina. And Rob, you wrote about this in Forbes, about the huge taxes and the lawsuits that could follow. First of all, welcome to Legal Face-Off. How are you?
Thanks, and nice to be here. I can assure you that the winner was not my client.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be spending your Friday with us, probably.
Indeed.
So, Rob, as Sam mentioned, we learned in the past couple of days that the winning ticket for the nearly $1.6 billion Mega Millions lottery jackpot was sold at the KC Mart in Simpsonville, South Carolina. Can you just tell us a little bit about when people win the lottery, what the choices are that the winner has in terms of how they receive their payout and what their tax obligations can look like and when those kick in?
Sure. So, I mean, the most fundamental choice really any size lottery winning is cash versus installment payments. There's no right answer. I guess I've seen people do it both ways. And I've also seen lots of other payments, for example, lawsuit settlements where people, you know, pick one or the other. The installment payments are taxed over time, and therefore, in a way, that is more tax efficient, if you will. People get more money that way. The $1.6 billion, I think, was discounted to something like 900 and something thousand if it's paid in cash. So that gives you an idea of the spread. If you get it in cash, obviously you get it all at once, and then you can spend it as opposed to getting it in installments. But I think anybody who is in this position should, you know, get some tax and some financial advice about what they should do.
So a lot of our listeners, obviously not Tina because she is already incredibly wealthy beyond all means, but you know, normal people among us fantasize about winning the lottery and, you know, talk about how people come out of the woodwork and, you know, family members. What should people do? What do you counsel your clients to do when they win, when they come into, you know, winnings from a lottery?
Yeah, and I mean, I think I believe there has been some case law over the question of whether the various lotteries are entitled to use your name, whether you can keep yourself private and not have your name publicized. You know, do you want to be on TV? Do you want to have, you know, stand there with this enormous check? I mean, I think there's no right way to do it, but I think the sort of the default notion is everyone's going to know who you are, and therefore, as you just said, people are going to come out of the woodwork. And some of those people, I mean, you may want to benefit. You may want to give gifts, make loans, but unfortunately, it's family members that you didn't even know you had can surface, and a lot of, you know, stockbrokers. I mean, people are going to get your details and hound you. And so some people, I think, are more, capable of dealing with that than others.
So, Rob, do you, knowing what you know, you are one of the country's leading tax experts. Knowing what you know, what would you recommend to people who win the lottery to split the proceeds with family and friends?
You know, I don't think you can recommend without knowing the facts. I mean, I can tell you, and this is unfortunately where some tax problems can arise, that apart from just the tax obligations, you know, they're 24% withholding to the federal government. So if they were going to pay you $1 million, you know, they would take 24% off the top and give you the rest if it's in cash. But, I mean, that doesn't stop your tax obligations. So you've got to file a tax return, which is due, you know, next year, the year after you get the money. And the tax return is going to generally, with any sizable sum of money, be taxed at the top 37% rate. So you've got to come up with the cash to pay the difference between 24% and 37%. I mean, that's just sort of the way the tax withholding works, that it doesn't cover everything. So, I mean, to some extent, you know, a lot of the decisions are going to be, what's the person's circumstances? What other assets do they have? You know, have they ever had significant money before? You know, might it all dissipate? There are a lot of famous, you know, and sad stories about people that, you know, end up in the poorhouse, even though they had a lot of money. So, which is certainly an argument in favor of taking the installments if you kind of know that you won't be so good at managing the money. But, I mean, they do give you a choice.
Rob, you mentioned earlier some lawsuits. I mean, generally, how do courts look at oral agreements to split winnings, right? We all sort of say to coworkers, hey, let's go in together and let's go buy a ticket. And yeah, if I win, we'll all split it. But I'm sure there have been lawsuits where people have actually tested whether those kind of promises hold up. Because, you know, no one's going to write down a contract when they go down to the store to buy a lottery ticket. How do the courts look at those agreements?
Yeah, no, I mean, you're exactly right. And this is one of these things where if you were, you know, if you were filing a lawsuit or something and, you know, two plaintiffs or two whistleblowers cooperating or something, I mean, that kind of thing does happen. And there are agreements, you know, they may be sort of hokey, but they're usually in writing of some sort. But with a lottery ticket, you know, people don't, and it really wouldn't make sense given the, you know, one in a million kind of chance or one in 300 million chance of sort of winning big. So, you know, these lawsuits are unfortunate, and they do happen, and I don't think there's a general rule. There have been a lot of cases that, you know, get thrown out. There have been a lot of cases that, you know, like most disputes, that get settled. And, you know, I think, yeah, but there have been some that have been, you know, oral agreements have been enforced. So I think, you know, sometimes the sort of pools can work fine. But I also think, I mean, they're dangerous because, you know, people can be dangerous when, you know, when there's a pile of money involved. So it's, it's a tough circumstance. I think it's made tougher by the fact that the tax rules on sort of lawsuit settlements are harder now, and harder as a result of the big tax bill that passed at the end of 2017. So a lot of legal fees aren't deductible anymore. You know, the old miscellaneous itemized deduction is gone. So, I mean, some people literally can, you know, have trouble deducting legal fees.
Rob Wood, managing partner, Wood LLP, attorneys at law. The website, woodllp.com. Rob, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliance solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsiveness, and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, That's compalliance.com.
Let's finish it off the way we always do on Legal Face-Off. Time for the legal grab bag. And joining us in the studio, Elif Garris from WGN Radio and Kathleen Murphy, who's the Director of Communication at the Illinois Opportunity Project. Kathleen has hosted the show. She's been on multiple times. Thank you both for joining us. Seven topics. Tina, take it away.
So our first story is about Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who on Tuesday of this week announced in a letter that she has the beginning stages of dementia, which is probably linked to Alzheimer's. And as a result, she announced that she would no longer be making public appearances. Apparently, she's been suffering from this condition for quite some time, and this is the very disease that took her husband's life back in 2009 and which triggered her retirement back in 2006. Justice O'Connor had actually testified before a Senate committee in 2008 about her husband's Alzheimer's diagnosis and was very frank and open about the trauma associated with the disease. In response to her announcement, Justice Roberts said he was sad to learn about the news, and he praised her and her efforts for breaking down barriers for women in the legal profession and for everything that she has done for bettering the profession. So, sad news. She is quite a lady.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kathleen, what are your thoughts? You followed Supreme Court for years. What are your thoughts on O'Connor? Not that she's passed away or anything, but what's her legacy of the court,
well,
in your opinion?
She was just a trailblazer for women. I mean, she was absolutely, broke down barriers at a time when women, you know, were not allowed, you know, allowed to advance their careers as fast as she did. So I think she'll be missing. And then just personally, my grandfather suffered from dementia. We lost him. That's a tough thing for a family to go through. So my heart goes out to her and her family.
Yeah. Elif, I know on your show you cover the Kavanaugh hearings extensively. Kavanaugh is now a sitting Supreme Court justice. A lot of people say that some of O'Connor's decisions, which were, you know, pretty centrist, are going to be overturned. Do you think, what are your thoughts on Kavanaugh as we go forward in the Supreme Court?
I think it was inevitable that he would be voted in. And I don't think we all saw it coming, but I also think that we kind of expected it based on the track record of the way that the last time something like this happened.
Yeah.
But she is a legacy. She's left behind a legacy, leaving the public eye, and she spent a lot of her life in the public eye. So I think it's good for her focusing on her, that she is retiring from that. But again, to your point about Kavanaugh, I think it's kind of sad for women and for Sandra Day O'Connor personally.
Yeah, ironic. O'Connor was the swing vote in Bush versus Gore, you know, one of the most consequential decisions, certainly in the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. O'Connor was a Republican. She was chairperson of the Maricopa County, Arizona Republican Party. And very famously, a story was told that when the networks called the 2000 election for Gore, she was watching at home, and she got up and said, "Oh, this is over. I'm going to bed." And then 6 weeks later, she cast the deciding vote, making George Bush president. So not a decision I thought was very... very, very strong. But that was one of her legacies. Let's move on to our next story, Tina, dealing with a common theme on our show, one that we've covered many times. There's yet another bakery discrimination story. What do we got going on here in Oregon?
Well, Rich and I were joking about this earlier, that our listeners are very familiar with the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which was decided this past June by the Supreme Court. That was the case involving Colorado baker Jack Phillips, who refused to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. In its narrow decision, the Supreme Court held that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had violated Phillips' free exercise rights because they did not employ religious neutrality. But what the court did not resolve was the broader question, which is whether a sincerely held religious belief like that of Phillips will trump neutral laws that apply to everyone. So now with the Oregon baker case, this question may be resolved in this case, for which a cert petition was filed back a few days ago by the former owners of this Oregon bakery that are asking the court to decide whether they had a First Amendment right to refuse to bake a custom cake for a same-sex wedding. In this case, Melissa and Aaron Klein said that they refused to bake the cake because of their firmly held religious beliefs that marriage should be between a man and a woman. They apparently are represented by the First Liberty Institute, and this stems back to 2015 when the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries claimed that the Kleins had violated the state's public accommodations law and ordered them to pay $135,000 in compensatory damages. And because they couldn't afford to pay those damages, they had to close their bakery.
So, Elif, on John Williams' show, I'm sure you've covered these stories extensively. What do you think the mood is out there, regardless of what the courts are doing? What do you think the public sentiment is with regards to whether people like bakers should be able to decide not to service people who are engaged in same-sex weddings? What do you think the mood is generally?
Divided.
Yeah, for sure.
I think
that's why these cases are in court, right? Because there's no consensus necessarily.
Right. I don't think that we as an American land, we're never all going to agree. And I just think that, in June we learned that, how do I put this? We learned that sometimes being inclusive is not the collective, is not an agreement in the United States. But that's an example that's been shown in many different ways, especially since the last election, presidential election.
Kathleen, the Illinois Opportunity Project is obviously a conservative organization.
Right.
Is there any that you've taken on this issue?
Well, if I were the baker, I would bake the cake. But I think err on the side of liberty in these situations. You don't want a situation where the government has so much power that they come in and they're telling, for example, private institutions what they can and can't do, or have the power to shut down a private business. This is one instance where someone's philosophical or religious beliefs conflicted with a job that they were being asked to do. Another example of that was the Little Red Hen, I think, was the restaurant that refused right. service to Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Should she be put out of business because her philosophical beliefs conflict with Sarah Huckabee
Interesting.
Sanders? Interesting. So I think that's a slippery slope to go down, and I think you err on the side of protecting liberty and freedom. And we have these conversations, and I mean, in order to be critical thinkers, sometimes, you know, you have to risk offending someone to have the conversation, but it's worthy of having.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Tina, what are your thoughts?
You know, I think it's a very, I agree with Kathleen that it's a very slippery slope, and it's one thing to, tell people what they need to do. But on the other hand, I mean, I can understand the conflict here. I mean, I personally would have said the baker needs to bake the cake, period. But, you know, I understand how it's a slippery slope. I understand why people are taking the other position, too.
So. What flavor cake was it, I wonder? Do we know? Any idea?
I don't know, but it was a wedding cake, so I mean.
Will, what's your favorite flavor cake? Do you like, are you a chocolate man or more of a vanilla?
Like Oreo ice cream.
Oreo ice cream cake. That's killer.
That is killer.
Sam, you're a man who loves his cake. What do you? Well, what's the Penny
like
Image lady cake going to taste like?
The Tres Leches cake, the three milk cake. It's amazing. Ooh.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
Okay, chocolate cake all the way every
all day.
Day.
Me too.
Chocolate cake.
I like chocolate on chocolate.
Chocolate on chocolate.
Yeah.
Nothing else. I want flour in that cake too.
Oh, for sure. I don't buy the flourless stuff. It's gotta have some, you know, depth to it. Kathleen, do you follow your son on the Oreo?
That is a good one. I like vanilla with chocolate chips. Like my mom does chocolate shavings into the vanilla.
I like that too.
Those sound good. Really
this
good.
Segment brought to you by Betty Crocker.
I know.
First name and cakes.
Pillsbury.
All right. One of our favorite subjects on Legal Face Off is Michael Avenatti, the other bald lawyer that we talk a lot about. What's going on
just
with Avenatti?
Just when you thought we
gotta get him on the show,
Bakers,
by the way. He has refused us so far, but
well, now that he's running for president, it's going to be impossible to get him on the show.
Yeah,
running for president. What else is going on?
Well, I was going to say it's been a big week for Michael Avenatti. So we started the week hearing that an LA judge ordered him to pay $4.85 million. to pay a former contract lawyer of his now defunct law firm. He was accused of breaching a personal guarantee to the lawyer, whose name is Jason Frank. Frank had accused the firm of owing him money under a contract that required them to pay him 25% of its annual profits, as well as 20% of fees that his clients paid to the firm. So the payout was part of a settlement agreement that was reached by the parties. And in separate bankruptcy litigation, the firm was found to have missed a $2 million payment that was required under the settlement, which was triggering an order from the court for the firm to pay $10 million to Frank. So that was the beginning of the week.
And then, he says the judgment should have been deducted from money that he's owed by this guy.
That's right.
Right? But the court never actually
found, no one's really talking about that.
Well, the court hasn't actually ruled that in his favor. He says that this other guy owes him $12 million, but the court hasn't actually ordered that yet. So.
No. So we'll see what happens there. And then there's obviously been a lot of press over the past few days that he is possibly going to run on the Democratic ticket for president. In the context of those reports,
Kathleen's excited by that prospect.
Yeah, I really want him
2020.
To.
Well, I mean, you wanted to, right?
So then there was that Time magazine profile that I'm sure everybody's heard about, where he claimed where the magazine profile claims that Avenatti said that it had better be a white male running against President Trump. And Avenatti says that that comment's being taken out of context. The claim was that he had said that it better be a white male because white men's arguments carry more weight. So that was a bit controversial. And then yesterday, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley actually referred both Avenatti and his client, Julie Swetnick, to the Justice Department for a possible criminal investigation over allegations that they had brought against Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation hearing several weeks
ago. Kathleen,
go.
I'm not even going to ask you a question.
I just want to know when the GoFundMe page goes up for this guy's campaign.
Avenatti 2020.
Honestly. My impression of him is he's just, this is going to come as a huge shock to everyone, but there are people who, you know, get in around politics just for attention and exposure. I know that never happens. But he strikes me as one of those guys who will do whatever he has to do, kind of just a scumball guy who will take on whatever he has to get the exposure and attention.
Well, most
that
people
he
say that his involvement, Elif, really turned around the Kavanaugh hearings because until then, there was two accusers who were fairly credible sounding. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of people say that when Avenatti got in, he raised the stakes and, you know, it really, you know, gained sympathy for Kavanaugh and rallied Republicans and many other people in favor of Kavanaugh because they perceived, you know, to
they
Kathleen's
said, this
point.
Is going,
just,
you guys are, this is a
just
witch hunt.
For
you guys are,
What were your thoughts on Avenatti's entry in the Kavanaugh affair?
I was intrigued only because we know him as Stormy Daniels' lawyer.
Right.
And I think the country saw him as what you described, which was just someone who wants to maybe provoke and someone who just wants to be an opportunist who wants
to be. It's unfortunate. I mean, if that allegation was true by his client, it's unfortunate that his involvement, you know, got in the
way. Tarnish
because
it, yeah.
I don't think that it should. I don't think that his involvement should discredit her. Accusations against him. But it's a shame that people see him as only Stormy Daniels' lawyer, to my own point.
Yeah. Kathleen, do you think Kavanaugh will have an asterisk? Do you think this fades over time? What are your thoughts on that?
For half the people in the country, it was a very divisive, painful thing for some people. It was, I really did see it as, you know, a witch hunt. I mean, and partly because of Avenatti's client, but I mean, it was clear that Christine Blasey Ford was put in front of the media and the cameras before she wanted to be. So I think he was damaged by it, and there will always be, you know, there always was around Clarence Thomas and the Anita Hill. Hearings too. So,
who plays Avenatti in the movie? There's got to be who are we thinking for early casting? Bruce Willis, maybe.
Rich Lenkov,
yeah, maybe. All right, moving on to our IP section of the grab bag. Tina, take it away.
So the bean. Everybody in Chicago and elsewhere loves the bean. So the sculptor, Amish Kapoor, who created the bean, sued the NRA for copyright infringement because the NRA included a clip of the bean in its video called The Clenched Fist of Truth. So he filed suit in the Northern District of Illinois claiming copyright infringement. And so the NRA filed a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. For all you laymen out there, it means that they claim that they didn't really have any meaningful connection to Illinois. And they said in the alternative, they would rather have the case transferred to Eastern Virginia, where its headquarters are based. And so, the ruling came down in the last couple of days that the case will continue. So the case has not been dismissed, but it is going to be tried in Virginia instead. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here with this case.
Moving on to another story that we've covered recently, a follow-up. Canada needs more weed. Plain and simple.
It just ran out.
Yeah, so we covered last time the fact that a couple weeks ago, Canada became the second country to legalize marijuana, recreational marijuana. And now there is a shortage of cannabis all across the country because of the huge amount of demand and lack of supply. A lot of dispensaries have run out of supply. Elif, what do you think of this? Should Canada just get many more suppliers? Should they decrease the demand somehow by increasing the amount of Funyuns in the country, or?
I think it depends on their financial situation, whether or not they need, obviously they have a market for weed, but whether or not they need it for fiscal reasons, and like Illinois is considering.
Sure.
Should
Illinois legalize it?
Yeah.
We just had Attorney General candidate Harold on saying that she would be in favor of it, yes?
Yes, she did.
So, do you think it's a good thing for Illinois?
Yeah, I do. And I still think that driving under the influence should apply to this, that law should apply to smoking weed. I mean, it makes things a little more dangerous, but I'd like to hear the medical side of what would happen from this, too.
Definitely. Jeff Sessions is against it. It's still a controlled substance under federal law. Is Canada doing the right thing? Should Illinois follow suit?
I actually have a solution for Canada. I think they should stop being so socialist and putting government in charge of everything. And there's a market opportunity here. You have a supply and demand issue. You have less.
Full disclosure at this point, I am Canadian. We all know that, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, we are. Yes. But you moved.
That's right.
To the United States.
Here we go. Yeah.
Oh, Corey. he's showing his lining again.
Yes. Sam, what are your thoughts on that? You're in a state that has legal marijuana right now.
First of all, I love that Kathleen put you in your place when she said you left. That's amazing.
Shut up.
Number one.
By the way, I left legally. I'm here.
You're not an illegal alien?
Any of you want to drop a dime on me, I'm a completely documented alien. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, we've got the Mounties on line 8. But anyways, like we've talked about on the show, I mean, the most popular thing for a lot of people when they come to Vegas, one of the first things they do, they ask me, where's the dispensary and where can we go and how much is this and how much is that?
Sam, whenever someone visits you, they always ask for drugs. So that has nothing to do with Nevada.
I'm not even talking about friends, though. I'm talking about people like my parents' age, people that are older than me, because it's legal here and you can do it. And you can walk up and down the street and you can take an edible gummy or you can smoke. I mean, it's legal here and people know that they feel safer and they feel more open with it when they come not just to Vegas but to any state where it is legal. That's just the reality of it.
Did you finish your point, your solution?
I mean, yeah, you have a market opportunity. This is an opportunity for entrepreneurial growers to provide for the additional desire from the market.
Yeah,
stop putting government in
Free
charge
market.
Of everything.
Free
we
market.
Don't do everything better.
I like it. All right, turning to Halloween. Sam, do you have any Halloween sound effects? Ben could add them later, maybe. But our Halloween, our usual Halloween edition of Legal Faceoff, we like to cover some legal stories involving Halloween. The first one is the dangers involved in office parties. How many of you will be attending a office Halloween party this year?
I.
Elif will be. Maybe we'll get invited to the WGN one this year, so maybe we'll go to that one. Kathleen, are you having a big Illinois opportunity.
Illinois
no one parties. No one parties like those DuPage County Republicans.
We will not be.
All right. Well, a lot of parties involve some questionable titles, like sexy whatever, mm-hmm. sexy vampire, sexy ghost. A lot of questionable costumes, and you know, because we're lawyers, there's got to be lawsuits. People will inevitably sue because they feel that their coworkers are wearing costumes that are too racy, too suggestive. Employers face a risk of being sued. Is this just political correctness run amok?
I mean, I think it's a nightmare for bosses to try to, like, you know, mitigate all these relationships. But I don't exactly understand entirely the legal issue. I mean, is it illegal to be offended now? Or is it, I mean...
Yes,
it is.
No longer offend or be offended.
I'm going to throw Rich in jail every week because he offends me.
Absolutely.
Can I just ask for a clarification? Are you saying that I could sue Ben for dressing to this or to that?
If Ben dresses in a way that makes you feel like you're in a hostile work environment, is the actual term, then you could sue not Ben so much because
my
Ben...
My boss.
You could sue WGN for making you feel that, you know, you're being harassed. I mean, you laugh, but these suits happen all the time mm-hmm. around Halloween. People say that because my coworker is dressing sexily, I feel like I'm being harassed.
Well, the liability's on the company then
sure.
because
right.
you've created the environment. Yeah, no, nightmare.
Tina, take us in the McDermott Halloween party. There is none.
There is none.
For this very reason.
For this very
Absolutely.
Reason. Every day is Halloween. No.
Do you guys remember the Office episode? It was Casual
yes.
Friday, and
yes,
everybody dressed inappropriately in some way that yes. offended another person. Yeah.
And then there were lawsuits.
Fantastic.
All right, last story dealing with Halloween is some weird, we always cover every year some weird Halloween lawsuits. Putting the costume ones aside, we picked some good ones that are real live lawsuits. So the first one is a case called Deborah Mays versus Gretna Athletic Boosters. This involves a haunted house in Louisiana, and they were sued. The haunted house was sued because, believe it or not, someone got scared. Wow, what a, a crazy thought that you'd be scared. This patron ran into a cinder block wall when an employee jumped out at her. She had two surgeries to repair a broken nose. And what do you think the court found? Elif, what do you think the court did with this case? Do you think they gave her money?
No.
Because, Kathleen, what do you think?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, why do you think not?
Because you're going to a haunted... If you scare easily so much that you jump and your body moves, then you shouldn't go to a haunted house.
Yeah, it's the old, very technical legal theory of, hey, dummy, you're in a haunted house.
Right.
Yeah, the court actually got it right in this case. And to your point, they found that the house doesn't owe a duty of care to her because you expect that when you go to a haunted house, you're going to be scared, mm-hmm. right? I mean, actually, when you go to a lot of them, on the back of the ticket, mm-hmm. you'll see a waiver of liability that you automatically sign by accepting the ticket that you don't get the right to sue them. But just basic common sense dictates that you shouldn't sue in a haunted house if you get scared. Kathleen, yeah?
I agree. Feel yeah, no, I agree with that.
Tina?
Yeah.
All right, next question. Our next case is a case involving a costume. Susan and Frank Fertillo attended a Halloween party dressed as Little Bo Peep and one of her sheep. Frank lit a cigarette, ignited his sheep costume,
oh, no.
which was made from Johnson & Johnson cotton balls. Well, guess what? They sued Johnson & Johnson. What do you think the jury found in this case? Kathleen, you want to take a stab at this one? Do you think
don't tell me they found Johnson & Johnson liable.
Well,
for this.
They did, and they got $625,000 in real money, not Halloween money, because the court found that they found the couple 50% at fault, but they also found Johnson & Johnson at fault. Now, the good news is the appellate court overturned the verdict, and they said, which again is basic common sense, that when you wear cotton, it's apparent that it's flammable. and that you should not light a cigarette around cotton.
Why didn't they sue the cigarette company then? Because there would have been no fire without that.
I mean, it is not the intended purpose of cotton balls.
Right. Well, typically, you know, these cases, there's a failure to warn argument that the manufacturer failed to warn of the dangers. But again, it's like, hey, dumbass.
Nowhere on when you look at like sort of what the intended uses are of cotton balls, and you know, they show you all these different uses on packaging, never once is it to be used as a Halloween costume. I mean, you're not, and none of the intended uses you're supposed to put anywhere near a flame or anything that is going to cause it.
Basic common sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, let's go around the room and talk about our Halloween costumes. Will, let's start with you. What are you going as this year? You're still in the trick or treat age, right?
Yeah.
Or are you too cool for it?
No, I'm not too cool.
Going as a Fortnite character, maybe?
No, I think I was going to go as Venom or...
Venom is cool.
Our group might go as the Power Rangers.
Awesome. Ben, costume this year? Or your favorite costume growing up? Either one. Or both.
Actually, I pulled off one of your favorites.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It was Bruce Willis.
Ooh.
From The Whole Nine Yards.
Wow.
Little Jimmy the Tulip.
That's going deep on that one.
Yeah.
Sam, favorite costume of all time, or what are you going as this year? Either one.
I haven't made up my mind this year. I got a couple days, but my favorite costume in 16 after the Cubs won the World Series, I was a Cub fan that said the wrong thing, and I had gotten beaten up. Like, you know, I chirped the wrong person and I got beat up at Wrigley, so I had like bruises and a ripped Wrigley Field shirt.
Pretty good. No danger of that this year.
No.
Elif, give us some insight into your Halloween legacy.
My favorite costume ever was Wednesday Addams a few years ago.
That's good.
And people thought my wig was my real hair.
Oh.
It was a braided black wig that was like this long down to my stomach.
Now, was it the Wednesday from the TV show or the movie? Because they're a little different.
It was the Christina Ritchie version.
Too young for the TV show version. Kathleen, come on.
When I was like 8, I went as an x-ray machine, and we just put this big box on and painted me like looking really sick and kind of greenish, and then put a skeleton decoration in the...
Still have it? Did you pass it on to Will?
It didn't make it, but it was very cool.
What could I expect if I knock on the Murphy house this year? You got fun-size bars?
Yes.
Some of that miserable candy corn? What do you got? Those?
I hate those.
No, we're doing the fun-size...
Fun size?
Yeah. A lot of the, gummy things.
Yeah.
Gummy bears?
No, the Sour Patch Kids.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Good.
That's a big hit.
Your
good
dentist
choice.
Is happy.
Yeah.
T-Mart, your favorite Halloween costume ever. What's Stina going as this? Do you guys have a theme together, you and David Sussler?
No.
No, like a
no,
pony or something?
No, he never dresses up as anything.
Nah, he's
no.
boring.
So when I was a kid, I was like in fifth grade, and I was in the Wizard of Oz in school, and I played the witch. And so I had this really, really cool costume. And so I actually took the costume and the face paint and all of that and went as the witch for Halloween. It was pretty gruesome. It was
cool.
Yeah.
We're digging deep in the memory bank there. I think you got transported there for a second. I've got.
What about you, Richie?
I mean, this is my thing, right? Halloween's my thing, so I've got a million. I mean, last year I went as Colin Kaepernick. That was pretty good. The year before, I like to go, you know, timely news story. So remember the dentist who killed that lion?
Oh, God.
I went as that guy a couple years ago. The lion.
Oh, did you? Oh,
too soon. Too soon.
Oh, my God. Did you wear that to your office party, though?
I did. And then the year before, you'll appreciate this one, Sam. I went as Adrian Peterson. I had a little baby.
Oh, my God.
I had a switch.
You're joking.
Well, hey, let me just give you a piece of advice.
Yeah.
Do not be Bill Cosby this year. No. Don't do it.
Don't be Bill Cosby, or Harvey Weinstein
either. I've got a good one.
Yeah.
I'm going to unveil it next week. But has anyone seen Halloween, the new Halloween movie?
No, but I love that movie. I love the original Halloween.
Super
it was
scary.
Awesome.
It was really good. Well, Sam, take it away on that note.
Thanks to Elif and to Kathleen. Of course, thanks to Ben for every show. For Rich and Tina,
and
my
Will.
Name is Sam. Have a happy Halloween. Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Contributor.
I forgot. I'm sorry, Will. My bad. I always forget. The best for last. Thank you, Will. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Face Off.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this. Now, courtroom combat going.